I'm speaking with Rupert Sheldrake, whose new book is Science Set Free, 10 Paths to New Discovery. Why do you think science needs to be set free?
Because I think it's got trapped in a kind of dogmatic belief system that really holds back scientific discovery. There's 10 assumptions which I discuss in my book, which are really rather central to modern science and which are believed by most scientists, not because they've been told you've got to believe this, but they're mostly implicit beliefs that they don't even know they have. You know, they assume these are not beliefs but truths.
So you're saying there's a kind of scientific creed that pretty much all scientists follow?
Yes. And if they don't follow it, then it leads to great disapproval or taboos or something like that. So it's very much built into the practice of science.
So give me a few examples of this. What's part of the scientific creed?
Well, first and foremost, nature is mechanical. Nature is machine-like. The universe is a machine. Animals and plants are machines. The human body is a machine. We're just lumbering robots, to use Richard Dawkins' vivid phrase. That's the first assumption. Second, matter is unconscious. There's no consciousness or awareness in matter anywhere. Atoms, electrons, solar systems, galaxies, it's all unconscious except some brains. And then the existence of consciousness in those brains like ours is very mysterious, because if matter is unconscious, how come there can be consciousness? Then the third dogma or assumption is that the laws of nature are fixed, and so are the constants. They were the same at the moment of the Big Bang as they are today, and they'll be the same forever. The total amount of matter and energy is always the same. That's another assumption, except at the moment of the Big Bang when all the matter and energy suddenly appeared. Nature is purposeless. Evolution has no purpose or direction. Minds are inside brains, confined to the inside of the skull. Those are just some of them, and these are assumptions which I think most scientists absorb implicitly rather than explicitly, and most people outside science just assume that these are scientific truths, and they must be true because science is so successful in giving us technologies like iPhones and computers and so forth.
Well, I want to talk about some of those more specifically, but what strikes me about your very discussion of a scientific creed is how counter, I think, that runs to what a lot of scientists say. I mean, they say that the practice of doing science is inherently about questioning assumptions and testing new ideas. There's nothing sacred. In fact, they would say that this is what distinguishes science from religion, which refuses to question doctrinal beliefs. You're saying science has its own sacred beliefs?
Oh, very much so. And I think they're actually more pernicious than the dogmas of religion because most scientists don't realize they're there. I mean, if you're a follower of a religion, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, or whatever, then you're aware that there are not only beliefs, but there's also disputes about the beliefs, different sects, different schools of thought. But if you're a scientist and you're brought up with the ideology that science is free from dogma and has rejected all dogmatic belief systems, it's a uniquely privileged, free method of inquiry, it doesn't occur to you that you yourself might be a victim of hidden assumptions or dogmas. And that's why most scientists are so blissfully unaware of that they're making these assumptions in the first place. They think other people have beliefs, but that they know the truth.
But what is it that science cannot explain?
Well, consciousness, for a start. This is a very knotty problem in the heart of science. And consciousness studies became an important part of science about 20 years ago. Before that, consciousness was virtually ignored. After all, the leading school of psychology in the US in the 20th century was behaviorism, and that simply regarded consciousness as a meaningless illusion. The only thing science could study was measurable behavior, muscular movements and glandular secretions. So consciousness is a huge problem, and consciousness studies is riven with debates about how can you possibly explain the existence of the mind. So there's one area.
You're saying that the basic problem there is how do you explain something immaterial, what happens in the mind, mental experience, just by looking at the brain, by the physical stuff in the brain?
Yes. I mean, however much you study nerve impulses and bits of the brain that become active when you look at the color red, for example, you can't explain the experience of redness. And this is what in consciousness studies and philosophy of mind is called the hard problem. The very existence of subjective experience isn't there in physics and chemistry, which is supposed to explain everything about nature.
Okay, so, I mean, one response to this would be to say it's hard to get a handle on that. Maybe it's just a problem beyond science, but it doesn't necessarily suggest that science itself is broken because it can't explain it.
Well, I'm not saying that science is totally broken. What I'm saying is there's certain areas where scientific inquiry is restrained by dogmas and assumptions that really inhibit free inquiry. I mean, consciousness is probably the best known of the problems, but there are other ones where people don't even know there's a problem. For example, the idea that the laws of nature are fixed. Nobody was there at the Big Bang to measure whether all the laws of nature were there. And the reason that people assume the laws of nature are fixed is simply an assumption carried over from an older cosmology. In the 19th century, most scientists thought the universe was eternal, made of eternal matter and energy governed by eternal laws. And so they took it for granted the laws of nature were fixed. Now we have a Big Bang cosmology. The universe came into being about 14 billion years ago. What about the laws of nature? Were they there before the Big Bang? How could they be? Did they all come fully formed at the moment of the Big Bang? Well, if so, how could one possibly know that? If the whole universe evolves, why shouldn't the laws of nature evolve too? And in fact, I suggest they're not really laws, they're more like habits. So you see, this is a question that's up for grabs. It's something one can discuss and debate, but not if one starts from the assumption the laws of nature are fixed, as if that's a given truth, only if one treats it as a hypothesis. So what I'm suggesting is that the 10 dogmas of science are treated not as truths, but as hypotheses that can be examined scientifically and tested.
So what changes, then, if you start to question some of these dogmas, some of these assumptions that the vast majority of scientists accept? Are there particular experiments you can run that would put some of these dogmas into question?
Oh, I think there are. I mean, well, take one of the dogmas that I myself accepted without question until I came to write this book. I challenged various other dogmas in the past, but not this one, and that's the principle of conservation of matter and energy, the idea the total amount of matter and energy is always the same. Now, that's something most people learn at high school in physics classes and just take for granted. But does physics itself follow that assumption? Well, in the late 20th century, people found that galaxies were attracting each other more than they ought to be, and that stars seemed to be moving around galaxies as if they were attracted towards the center more than they should have been. In fact, this effect was a very big effect. And so to deal with that, they simply hypothesized or postulated dark matter, about five times as much as regular matter. So the amount of matter in the universe went up fivefold, in the space of a decade, without anyone blinking. It was just, okay, that's fine, physicists say there's dark matter. They still don't know what it is. Then, because there was so much dark matter, the universe had too much gravity, which meant that the expansion should be slowing down, and then it should stop expanding and then begin to contract. But in the late 20th century, people found that actually the universe was accelerating in its expansion. It wasn't slowing down, it was speeding up. So to explain that, they invoked dark energy, a new form of energy. Dark matter and dark energy now make up more than 96% of reality. The physics and chemistry we learned at school accounts for less than 4%. Now, can we be sure that all that dark matter and dark energy is constant in amount, that it never changes, that it was all there at the moment of the Big Bang, that it isn't converted to regular forms of matter and energy, that more regular matter and energy could appear or disappear? How do we know that? We don't know what dark matter and dark energy are, and they're more than 96% of reality, according to physics itself.
Are you suggesting that maybe there is no dark energy and dark matter, and these ideas were just invented to make the formulas work?
Yes, essentially. They're invented to make the formulas work. But that doesn't mean to say they don't exist. They might exist. But if they do exist, let's take seriously the possibility that dark energy and dark matter do exist, and also that in the quantum vacuum field, which is a standard part of quantum physics, which is supposed to be an ocean of energy on which the world we know is just floating, what if some of those forms of energy were convertible to regular energy? We might have a completely new kind of technology then. And right out there, at this very moment, there are dozens of people who claim to have so-called above-unity or free energy devices which convert other forms of energy into regular energy, producing vastly more energy than you put in. Now, anyone who's been to high school and studied physics knows that these devices must be impossible. Perpetual motion machines, totally impossible, complete taboo. So people who have these inventions are met with a wall of ridicule and disapproval and relegated to the fringes of science. Now, what if some of these things really work? I don't know if they do or not, but you asked what would make a difference. Well, I think this would make a difference. How I would find out if I had more funds than I do have would be to set up a prize, say $1 million prize for the best above unity device, and let people who have these devices bring them forward, let them be tested fairly by independent experts who are not there to try and debunk them, but to find out if they really work. If any really do work, they'd win the prize. If none of them work, then at least they'd have been fairly tested, and we'd know the conventional position would be strengthened rather than weakened. But right now, no one in the scientific world will take these things seriously because there's such a strong taboo against this being a possibility. That's one of the areas, you see, where I think these taboos have a severely inhibiting effect on scientific inquiry.
Now, you also have some fascinating things to say about the animal world. For instance, homing pigeons, how they find their way. And I guess this goes back to your own childhood, right? I mean, you kind of had a fascination with pigeons.
Yes, I always was interested in pigeons. I kept pigeons as a child, and I got very interested, how did they find their way home? Nobody seemed to know. When I was at Cambridge, I was teaching biology at Cambridge, I asked my colleagues, how does it work? And they all said, oh, well, it must be magnetism, or it must be the sun's position. They came up with a whole variety of theories. Well, all these theories have now been tested to destruction. It's not just the sun's position, because they can do it on cloudy days and when their time sense is shifted, which they'd need to navigate by the sun. It's not just magnetism, because although pigeons do indeed seem to have a magnetic sense, that can't tell you where you are. It just tells you where north and south are. If you're parachuted into an unknown place and given a compass, you wouldn't be able to find your way home. You'd simply know where north and south are. So there's a huge problem about pigeon homing and bird navigation and migration in general.
You're saying that scientists really still don't have a clue how birds find their way?
Yes, they don't have it. Well, they have a clue. The clue is that magnetism plays some role in some species. The other theories, remembering the outward journey, navigating by the sun or stars, seeing landmarks, all these things have been ruled out. It simply can't apply to a pigeon homing from 600 miles away. They fly straight home. They can't possibly see landmarks. And the magnetic theory is, I think, scraping the bottom of the barrel. I think that it's a desperate last attempt to explain it in a seemingly rational manner. I myself think that there's a possible explanation. My own hypothesis is that pigeons are linked to their home position by a kind of field. I call it a morphic field, a bit like an invisible elastic band that connects them to their home and, as it were, pulls them homeward. So I think there could be a quite different basis for the sense of direction from the known forces and chemical influences that scientists study at the moment. But you see, you can't study such an unknown thing if you assume it can't exist or doesn't exist. And again, there's a taboo which inhibits free inquiry here. I mean, it's right for scientists to be conservative, to say, well, let's try and figure it out in terms of known principles. They've been doing that for 100 years with pigeon homing and still come up with a blank, or at least just the vain hope it might eventually turn out to be magnetism, whereas we know in theory just on theoretical grounds, that alone can't explain it.
Well, you've been talking about your theory of morphic fields or morphic resonance for a number of years now, and most scientists say this is impossible, and there's no proof for it. How do you respond to those criticisms?
Well, saying it's impossible is simply saying the existing dogmas of science are all we need. We know the truth already. What I call the science delusion is the belief that science already knows how reality works in principle, leaving any of the details to be filled in. That's definitely an inhibitory factor for free inquiry. So I would say that people saying it's impossible, it's not impossible. I mean, it's perfectly possible.
But is there any
some
proof?
Well, there's quite a lot. Yes, there's quite a lot of evidence that morphic resonance may really happen. For example, in the case of animal behavior, the theory predicts that if you teach rats to learn a new trick in San Francisco, rats all over the world will learn it quicker because the rats have learned it in San Francisco. Now, there's already evidence from laboratory experiments that morphic resonance effects do seem to happen.
Can you explain that?
Rats do learn quicker.
Why, if rats in San Francisco learn how to do something, why would that catch on with rats elsewhere who had never had any contact with those San Francisco rats?
Well, that's because of that's a postulate of the theory of morphic resonance. And so maybe I should back up a little and say a little bit more about what the theory says. The theory says that there's similar patterns of activity in self-organizing systems, which include crystals, cells, brains, plants, societies of animals, that similar patterns of activity influenced by a kind of resonance across time and space, subsequent similar patterns. And what this boils down to is that each species has a kind of collective memory. It's what the physicist David Bohm called the implicate order, which is influenced by what happens in the explicate order, what the world we know. He made a similar prediction on the basis of his theory of quantum physics. I call it morphic resonance.
It sounds a little like Carl Jung's idea of the collective unconscious.
It is like that. I mean, but Carl Jung was talking about it in relation to humans, and I think that it happens with humans, but all other species too. In fact, I think it's a general principle of nature, not just a feature of human psychology. So one of the predictions this theory makes is that if rats learn a new trick in one place, they should learn it quicker elsewhere. Now, that's a very surprising prediction. It wouldn't happen on the basis of any other theory that I know of. So is it true? Well, this has been tested, and it turns out that something like this really does happen. Now, people might say, well, it's not enough proof. We want more. There's actually quite a lot of evidence from animal behavior this happens, and indeed from human psychology.
Can you give me one or two examples of that, showing that this kind of learning does happen?
Well, there have been a number of specific tests for morphic resonance that have given positive results, but I think probably the best example is one where there's no dispute about the facts, which is the so-called Flynn effect in IQ measurement. It was discovered in the late 1980s by James Flynn, a New Zealand psychologist, that average IQ scores were going up in the US and in Europe and in Japan, in fact, all over the world. It's a big increase. It's more than 30% in the 20th century. And there's no very clear explanation of the Flynn effect. Various people have tried to explain it by saying, well, people are getting smarter because they have better food, they're more urbanized, etc.
Or that they go to school more often.
Or that they go to school. But the point is, there's no independent evidence that they're actually getting more intelligent. The only thing that's happening is that they're getting better at doing IQ tests. Well, I predicted in the early 1980s, before this effect was discovered, that IQ test scores should rise, not because people are getting smarter, but because so many people have already done the IQ tests. By morphic resonance, they pick up on how to answer the questions. That there'd be a rising IQ score, not because of rising intelligence, because the questions are getting easier. And I think that explains the facts. There's no dispute about the facts. There's a lot of controversy about how to explain them. No one really can explain them, except, I think, the morphic resonance theory. So here's an anomalous lot of data that there's no dispute about the data. Everyone agrees the Flynn effect is real. And it was actually predicted by me before it was discovered on the basis of morphic resonance. And the evidence supports this idea. The idea also suggests that it should be getting easier to learn new skills like windsurfing, computer programming, playing particular video games, skateboarding. All these things do seem to be getting easier to learn. But of course, in these cases, there could be the effect of instructional videos, better training methods, improved technology, etc., etc. IQ tests have the great advantage that they're a standardized test used over many, many years, and where the evidence is much more clear-cut, that it's not just other factors. I'm not saying the evidence for morphic resonance is overwhelming, but I'm saying that there is quite a lot, and that this theory explains a lot of things which regular science doesn't. I'm not saying I'm right, they're wrong. All I'm saying is this is an open question, and that to close the question down, as some of my colleagues would like to do, is not a scientific way to proceed. In fact, in all these disputed areas I discuss in my book, Science Set Free, the questions are actually open questions.
Well, what I find so interesting about what you're saying is the fact that you are a scientist yourself. I mean, these are kind of heretical things for a scientist to say. I mean, and we should just take a moment to talk about your background. I mean, you were educated at Cambridge and Harvard, had a distinguished career in biochemistry, became a research fellow at the Royal Society and a professor at Cambridge University. When did you start to question the materialist assumptions of science?
I think when I was at Harvard, I read Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and that made it clear to me that science at any given time is not the truth. It's a consensus reality. Kuhn showed that scientists are social beings like everyone else, and that a scientific consensus at any given time is like a fashion, that and normal science happens within that framework. To challenge its assumptions is heretical. But scientific revolutions occur when a new framework of thinking is established, and then normal science takes place again within that framework. I think that first gave me the idea there might be something, some possibility that the present science may not be the final answer. But it was really my work in developmental biology at Cambridge that made me realize that just by analyzing genes and chemicals and chemical influences and physical changes in cell membranes and so on, wasn't enough to explain morphogenesis, the development of form. There was a concept already pretty mainstream in developmental biology of morphogenetic fields, of form-shaping fields, which I found very helpful. I didn't invent it. It's been around since the 1920s, and it's still part of developmental biology. But no one knew how morphogenetic fields could be inherited. And it was really the thinking about that, the inheritance and evolution of these fields, that led me to think of the idea of morphic resonance, a kind of memory in nature over and above genetic inheritance. I then put forward the theory. I put it forward in my first book, A New Science of Life, recently reissued in a new edition as Morphic Resonance.
And we should mention that it generated quite a response. John Maddox, the editor of the journal Nature, famously said that your book should be burned.
Yes, well, you see, that's what made me realize that science is not a level playing field where different ideas can be freely discussed in a rational spirit. He branded my work heresy, heresy because it went against what people currently believe. And I found that this was rather hard. You know, I had to face the fact that I'd been brought up to believe that science was an open, free inquiry where you could put forward a hypothesis, collect evidence, test it, discuss it rationally with your colleagues. And I ran into a reality which was very different from that, much more like the world that Thomas S. Kuhn described in his book, where there's a kind of given orthodoxy at any time. Anyone who steps outside that orthodoxy is branded a heretic. And as it were, Maddox tried to excommunicate me from the scientific community. Well, that's not the way I think science ought to work. And I think that's the way it does work, though. And one of the reasons that I wrote this book, Science Set Free, is because I think this same stigma against heresy applies in many areas of science. It terrifies most scientists. Most scientists are not prepared to come out and talk about their doubts or unconventional theories unless they're in a very, very powerful position, like a Nobel Prize, then they can become more unconventional. But it's career suicide to question the dogmas. You won't get your grants renewed. You won't get your papers in high citation peer review index journals. You won't get your promotions or tenure or whatever. There's a reign of fear in science which is completely at odds with the ideal of free inquiry.
Are you saying there are a lot of scientists who actually would talk about some of these ideas, these heretical ideas, kind of off the record, you know, around beers at night, and it's just that they're never going to do this publicly?
Absolutely. It's not just a theory. I know it's a fact. I mean, because I myself am, I've been putting forward what are often called heretical views for years and done research in heretical areas like telepathy and so on. I know very well that there are plenty of scientists who are open to these ideas. I have a lot of friends in, you know, some of the highest positions in science in Britain and elsewhere. I hang out with them in the evenings. We talk freely. But they've never mentioned this in public because they know it would damage their career.
And the analogy that you have suggested is, I mean, you're really asking scientists to come out of the closet. I mean, the explicit analogy here to the gay rights movement.
Well, exactly that, yes. You see, because if think about the 1950s, there were lots of people who were gay and pretended to be straight at work and even to their families because they were afraid they were a tiny minority, they'd be ridiculed, persecuted, etc. But a lot of people were working beside each other and were all pretending to be straight when some of their colleagues were gay too. When they came out, their life, I think, in many cases, got much easier. I think science is full of closet holists or people who have religious beliefs or spiritual practices or psychic experiences or who go to alternative therapists and so on, but who don't dare tell their colleagues. I know this is the case because what gave me this idea, actually, is that I was once asked to give a seminar on some work I did on dogs that know when their owners are coming home. It appears to be a telepathic effect. Many dogs seem to know when their owners are coming home in a way that can't be explained by routine or familiar car sounds or people at home knowing. Anyway, I did lots of experiments on this and published them in peer-reviewed journals. I gave a seminar on this at a leading British university in the veterinary school. There was a sub-department of people working on dogs and companion animals. There were six members of staff and some students. It was a small group. After the seminar, over tea, one after another of the members of staff came up to me and said, you know, I know this is true because my dog knows when I'm coming home from the lab. My wife always knows when I'm coming. Another one said, we had a dog that did that when I was a child, and it's one of the reasons I went into this whole field of study. All of them came up and said they were interested, they thought I was right, but they all said, I can't discuss this with my colleagues because they're all so straight. When all six, including the professor, had said the same thing to me, I said to them, you know, why didn't you guys come out? Because you'd have so much more fun if you talked freely instead of all pretending that you can't discuss these issues. Just forget the taboo and talk freely. I think that if scientists did that, and that's one of the things I really hope my book will help to do, is to set scientists free to talk about their own experiences and their own doubts and their own alternative theories, instead of all paying lip service in public to a kind of materialist orthodoxy.
And I should mention that, I mean, your ideas about telepathy have, not surprisingly, generated a lot of criticism. And one of your sparring partners, the well-known British biologist Lewis Wolpert, has described telepathy as pathological science. Peter Atkins, a famous chemist at Oxford University, has said work in this field is a complete waste of time. It's a fairly standard response from scientists, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And you see, this is one of my points about scientific taboos, why it's an illusion to think scientists are free, open-thinking people who just look at the evidence rationally. I challenge to both those gentlemen, Lewis Wolpert and Professor Atkins, to public debates. I had one with Professor Wolpert at the Royal Society of Arts in London with a High Court judge in the chair. It was reported in Nature, the scientific journal. I presented half an hour's evidence for telepathy from hundreds of published papers. I showed some videos of experiments and so on. He stood up in complete ignorance of all this evidence and simply said over and over again, it's pathological science, it's rubbish, it doesn't happen, with no evidence whatsoever. When I was showing the evidence, he was sitting on the stage. He was staring into the audience, tapping a pencil on the table, sighing as if bored, and not even turning around to look at the evidence that was on the screen behind him. So this was a complete denial of the evidence. And when I debated with Professor Peter Atkins, who denounced this as rubbish, I said, have you actually looked at the evidence? And he said, certainly not. And I said, well, why not? And he said, because I know it's not going to be reliable. And I said, well, have you actually read my papers on the subject? He said, no, but if I did, I'd be very suspicious of them. So I said to him, well, you know, there's a word for that. It's prejudice. This is a kind of behavior which is not scientific, it's not rational, and people who have those attitudes are given a completely undue credibility in the public press and in the media, as if they're authorities. I would never denounce research in astrophysics or physical chemistry on the basis of complete ignorance. But people feel able to denounce what they see as heresies in science from a position not of well-informed factual knowledge, but of prejudice and ignorance. That's really bad for science, and I think those attitudes are so common within the sciences that they're really inhibitory to a genuine scientific endeavour. That's one of the reasons I've written the book Science Set Free, because I think it's so important for science to be able to look at questions, to discuss them freely and openly, without these knee-jerk taboos that have become built into the culture of science.
Is this an argument about science, about what's the best direction for science, or are you making a larger point? Are you trying to carve out space for reconciling science with spiritual experience?
That's not my primary motive. When I started this work on morphic resonance, I was working simply as a developmental biologist trying to find a better way of doing developmental biology. It does have spiritual implications. The dominant ideology of science at the moment is materialism. These 10 dogmas are the dogmas of materialism. And materialism is inherently atheistic. There are many scientists who are not atheists, but when they're at work, they go along with the materialist paradigm or orthodoxy because that's simply the prevailing ethos. Professor Richard Dawkins used to be a professor of public understanding of science at Oxford. And he's, of course, a well-known, prominent, and militant atheist. He equates the scientific worldview with atheism. Now, I think that's very bad for science, too. I think that for science to become linked to one particular position, one particular belief system, namely the atheist belief system, is really bad for science. I think it should be open. I don't think it should be committed to atheism or Christianity or Judaism or any religious or philosophical position. And atheism is an anti-religious position based on a particular philosophy or ideology, materialism. And I think that clouds the issue in the debate about science. I think science should be neutral and not linked to either to pro or anti-religious points of view.
Well, I have to ask about your own perspective. Do you consider yourself a spiritual or a religious person?
I do, yes. I was an atheist for years. I absorbed the standard scientific atheist view. I had a kind of Dawkins-type atheist view when I was a student and when I was a graduate student. I changed my mind, really, through getting interested in meditation and yoga. I lived in India, worked in an agricultural institute, an international institute in India, as a scientist. And when I was in India, I got very interested in Hindu philosophy and meditation. And then, surprisingly, when I was in India, found myself drawn back to a Christian path. And at present, I consider myself a Christian. I'm an Episcopalian in the U.S. terms. In Britain, I'm an Anglican, a member of the Church of England, which is a liberal kind of Christianity. I have no liking at all for Christian fundamentalism or any kind of fundamentalism, whether it's Christian, scientific, Islamic, or whatever. So I think there's a spiritual reality, greater forms of consciousness than human consciousness, and I think that's part of the way the world is.
During your time in India, didn't you also spend some time at the ashram where the exiled Christian teacher Bede Griffiths was?
He wasn't exactly exiled. Yes, I did live in his ashram. I wrote my first book, A New Science of Life, when I was staying there. I wouldn't say he was exiled. He'd gone to India because he wanted to study Indian spirituality. He found the Christian tradition, as it was practiced, rather too limiting in that it didn't have very much in a meditative tradition or the yoga tradition, which he greatly respected. So he himself was a great pioneer and explorer in the realm of spirituality. I found him an extremely congenial man to be close to, and I stayed in his ashram. I needed somewhere to write a book, and he offered me the hospitality of his ashram to do it there. So he was certainly a big influence on my life. The point about Bede Griffiths was that he had an integrative mind. He was not trying to close things down. He was trying to open things up. He was not trying to convert Indians to Christianity or Christians to Hinduism, but to explore what it is that different spiritual traditions have in common and what also they have, what are their real differences. Not saying, I'm right, you're wrong, but trying to find out together what's going on. And I think that's the kind of spirit we need in science. And funnily enough, I find much more broad thinking, much more open and inclusive thinking among people in the religious world, particularly in the Anglican, Episcopalian, Christian world, than I do in the scientific world, where this rather narrow, often shrill dogmatism is the prevailing tone.
Well, do you have other intellectual heroes, maybe from, I don't know, previous eras, who've made a similar critique of materialism and the kind of scientific dogma you've been talking about?
One of them is Goethe, the German poet and scientist who was a botanist and worked on the theory of colors. And he's one of my heroes because he thought that science should proceed in a kind of holistic way, that it should tie in our experience with experiment and observation rather than ignoring direct human experience. I think that's really important, that we should include our experience and not split ourselves between scientific knowledge and the rest of our experience, which current science does to a large degree. So Goethe was one hero. Aristotle is another, the great Greek philosopher, because he's the last great philosopher who was a biologist. Most philosophers of science have been physicists or primarily interested in physics. Darwin is a great hero of mine. I like Darwin's works very much, and I love the way that Darwin was able to challenge the orthodoxy of his time and work so freely and independently. He represented an earlier era of science when scientists could be free and independent in their thinking without having to be afraid of where the next grant was coming from. He worked independently because he was financially independent. He never had a government grant or an academic post. And his books show a tremendous respect for the knowledge gathered by practical men and women, plant breeders, explorers, people who developed new strains of pigeons or dogs. And he based his research on the observations and discoveries of amateur naturalists, colonial administrators, explorers, and so on. And he did so in this wonderfully free spirit. So Darwin is one of my greatest scientific heroes, really. And he was by no means a shrill, reductionistic materialist. He was an agnostic in matters of religion, but remarkably inclusive and open-minded mind, and prepared to explore all sorts of areas of biology which were ignored by his colleagues. And he was unafraid of controversy. He didn't personally like coming out and fighting for the evolutionary theory. But he put forward radical views, including views on the evolution of humanity, the evolution of emotions, and so on, which were stimulating then and are still stimulating today. And I think he's a wonderful example of an independent scientific thinker.
Suppose someone out there in our listening audience liked what you said, had some money, and said, I want to, you know, give this Sheldrake guy an opportunity to test his theories. I'm going to give him $10 million. What kind of studies would you want to put forward to test some of your ideas, to challenge some of these scientific dogmas you've been criticizing?
Well, that's a very good question. And in fact, just before I came to North America a couple of months ago, I gave a soiree, a seminar at a think tank, a financial think tank in London, and I just asked them that very thought experiment. Is it conceivable there could be a fund like $10 million that could fund unorthodox research? I think this is feasible. In fact, there are some billionaires that I've met recently in London who are actually interested in this. So this is not just an idle thought experiment. It could actually happen. And one of the things, of course, would be my pet interest of morphic resonance. There are some quite simple experiments that could be done which could show whether or not morphic resonance is really working in developmental biology, which is my primary area of interest.
Tell me about one of those experiments.
Okay, well, this is something which is going on now, and it's not published, so I can't go into the enormous detail because I'm working with someone on this in London. But I can give you the outlines of it. It turns out that if you take strains of cells and expose them to heat shocks, you can do this with yeast, for example, expose it to heat repeatedly, this kills off cells that aren't heat tolerant. You do it and you breed from the ones where you've killed off the ones that aren't heat tolerant. You breed from the survivors and you give another heat shock and you go on doing this. And sure enough, you find you evolve a strain of yeast cells which is more heat tolerant. That's straightforward sort of Darwinian evolution. But if you then look at the heat tolerance of a control line of yeast cells that hasn't been exposed to heat, that should show no change in heat tolerant. And yet, the heat tolerance in those control cells actually increases. Now, that's the kind of effect I would predict by morphic resonance. It seems to happen. There's already evidence this is going on. There's also work which I discuss in the new edition of A New Science of Life called Morphic Resonance, that this kind of effect happens in cultured mammalian cells in published reports. Are these just experimental artifacts? Is there something wrong with the experiments? Can they be repeated, these observations, which have already been done several times? That's one area where fairly small investment could yield quite interesting results, very interesting results. I would not, of course, confine this $10 million fund to my own research interests. I mean, I'm not in this for the money. I'm not trying to say, give me the money. But there's a whole series of areas where research, I think, could be really illuminating. Take animals and earthquakes. This is an area I wrote about in my book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. And I've been studying this for 20 years. Before most major earthquakes and tsunamis, there are many signs of unusual animal behavior. Dogs start behaving strangely. Cats seem to be afraid, anxious, and hide. Rats come out of their holes.
You're saying before any tremors have been detected? I mean, there's no sort of physical evidence of the coming earthquake?
That's right. Before, like, tsunamis and earthquakes. I mean, the point is that we don't have warnings from tremors of earthquakes in a way that seismologists can give us warnings. If so, all the earthquakes recently, we would have had adequate warnings from seismologists, and we haven't had. They're not able to give short-term predictions. But animals, in many cases, for example, before the Assisi earthquake in 1997, I had a research assistant on the spot within days, an Italian-speaking research assistant. Before that big earthquake, which damaged the Basilica of St. Francis in Assisi and neighboring towns. Several days before, rats were coming out of their burrows and terrifying tourists who were eating on restaurant terraces. Snakes were coming out of holes. Dogs were howling in the night. Vets were getting people taking animals to them, saying they couldn't work out what was wrong with them. There was all sorts of unusual animal behavior for several days before the earthquake. Now, this happened before the Greek and the Turkish earthquakes, before the Seattle earthquake in 2001, before the 1994 Northridge quake in California, before the Loma Prieta quake in 87. And before the great tsunami in Asia on the 26th of December a few years ago. Now, here's all this evidence. The Chinese have actually used this to predict earthquakes since 1975 successfully, much more successfully than any Western seismologists. So it wouldn't cost much to set up a earthquake warning system, a hotline that people could phone, a website they could report unusual behavior to. This could actually be practical and useful. I've tried to interest seismologists in this, and I've met with nothing but contemptuous dismissal. You know, this is just folklore. These guys who report these things are only reporting it after the event. It's just superstition. Earthquakes are a physical science. It's got nothing to do with biology. How would these animals know anyway, etc.? Every reason for dismissing these fascinating findings, which were always reported in newspapers, and ordinary people find them very interesting, as I do myself. But within the official scientific world, it's just a complete contemptuous dismissal. No one's prepared to look at it. Now, for a fairly small sum, one could set up, hire a few people to set up websites, to have a public relations drive, to let people know what number to call, what website to report these things to, and to find out on an experimental basis if this really works. If it does, systems of this kind could be set up in Greece, Turkey, India, Pakistan, all the world's earthquake-prone areas. Everyone now has mobile phones and computers and internet access. We could have an effective earthquake warning system at relatively low cost, a fraction of the cost of modern seismology research. That's something I'd put money into. And right now, no one will put money into it. It doesn't fit under the sort of NSF grant system. It doesn't fit under corporate research budgets. There's a whole areas of science. I list them in my book, Science Set Free, where relatively modest investments could lead to major changes in, indeed, practical discoveries.
We could go on, but we should leave it there. Thank you so much. This has been fascinating.
It's a pleasure.